Welcome to This Is Money. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is reporter George Nixon. And it could be you. Granted, it's unlikely, but as the National Lottery turns 25, we hear from one of the first winners about how she's lived off her jackpot. Plus, we ruminate on a lottery concept that it could encourage millions to save. Also today, we look at no-deposit mortgages for students. A good idea. Can online firms really find out about your card detail changes before you do? And my favourite time of the year, it's Black Friday. We'll let you know how to avoid the scams, if not the day, the week, the month itself. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app first. I can't believe it's a quarter of a century since the first National Lottery draw. I remember it well. George, you were probably not even an apple in your parents' eye. Don't even answer that because it'll make me feel depressed. Noel Edmonds, Simon, you and I might remember this. Anthea Turner live on BBC, 19th November 1994. 22 million people tuned in to watch that. Fast forward, though, to now, it's created 5,500 millionaires, handed out $71 billion in prize money, though not to me at all. So to celebrate, This Is Money tracked down one of the first millionaires the draws created to see how they got on. But before we find out more about Elaine and Derek from Newcastle, just take us back to the heady days of the mid-90s. Simon, obviously not George.
Well, I can not only take you back to the heady days of the mid-90s, I can take you all the way through from the mid-90s to today, when a certain mug who is sat in this studio is still playing the lottery. And
are
he's still
you?
Playing the lottery twice a week, because when the lottery launched, you had to pick six numbers. And I know my six numbers. 7, 12, 16, 32, 36, 42. Sounds like a bad episode of Lost, doesn't it? But those numbers are in my head. And because those numbers are in my head, I have to play the lottery every week. And it used to be a frantic dash down to the newsagent. You wouldn't believe how delighted I was when they started doing two lottery draws a week rather than the one, so that I could double the amount that I was spending. And eventually, I just took out a direct debit. So I now have a direct debit for two lottery games, Wednesday and Saturday. And I consider it to be my mental health insurance. It's my little... It won't be me. It almost certainly won't be me. I've long got over that idea. But it's that little bit of money that I have to spend every week just to make sure that it wasn't me and I missed out because I didn't buy a ticket.
Have you ever won? Have you ever won anything? Because I've never won anything, but then I don't play. So that's,
so,
you know,
if we go back
obvious.
To 1995. So interestingly, I think I can remember where I first bought my ticket. My first ticket. I think it was the... I think it was a co-op in St Albans, actually, after school. Now, I was also 15 years old, and you do have to be 16 to play the lottery.
Yeah.
But the offer of becoming an instant millionaire just by picking six numbers was not something that I was going to pass up. Fortunately, in those days, they were much less keen on checking your age for things like cigarettes and alcohol, and they really couldn't give two hoots about a lottery ticket. Had I have won, obviously they could have refused to give me the prize, but I think I decided I'd cross that bridge when I came to it. I've still yet to get to that bridge. Unfortunately, I'm over 16 now, so it wouldn't be a problem. And I didn't win for years. In fact, you know, the first time I won a tenner was when I was at university. So from the age of, you know, almost 16 through to, and I started university when I was 19, I didn't win anything, and I was playing most weeks. And since then I have won. Every so often I get an email telling me I've won a tenner. Every so often I get an email telling me I got two numbers right, and so you then get a free entry into the draw as well. You get an extra entry. And this is great. I mean, like, I don't know how many of these I would need to get before I become a millionaire, but it's a hell of a lot. But the odds are terrible. It's an absolute mug's game spending the money on the lottery, but it's not a lot of money unless you're stupid enough to be playing it twice a week, every week of your life. But as I said, it's an insurance policy against those numbers ever coming up. And people say, well, why don't you just avoid the National Lottery results? Which is easier now than it used to be, because there's much less fanfare about it. But I work for a newspaper organisation. They publish the lottery numbers, and they're not always on the same page.
True.
So you never know when you might see them.
So the tip then, Simon, is just do the random number. If you want to play, keep it random.
If you want to play the lottery, do the lucky dip. Never choose your numbers, never remember your numbers. And if anybody ever says to you, offers you some kind of Men in Black style pen flash scenario to forget the six numbers, maybe consider taking them up on it.
Right. Okay, good advice. But you did actually speak to someone who did win.
Yeah.
Way back when. Elaine and Derek from Newcastle. I think they won, what was it, 2.7 million?
They did. And I mean, that's amazing. So £2.7 million in 1995. Yeah. Now, bear in mind that £2.7 million in 1995 was worth considerably more money than it is now.
Because, have you worked it out?
Well, you wouldn't struggle. We haven't worked this out, but we have an inflation calculator where you can mm-hmm. do. I mean, bear in mind that in 1995, you would have really struggled to spend £2.7 million on a house for a start.
Yeah.
Whereas now, it'd be quite easy to spend your £2.7 million if you live in certain parts of the country and go, oh, I've got nothing left. But they did win. It's a brilliant story. Elaine said, I was sitting with my children watching the television, and when the lottery numbers came up, I recognised the numbers and said, we've won a tenner. But after properly checking my ticket, I realised we'd won millions. However, after finding out about the win, Elaine, who is now 63, said no one would actually stay on the phone long enough to hear the exciting news. I rang my mother-in-law, who screamed and then hung up. I rang a friend who runs a pub, and she said she was busy and put the phone down. I ended up going to my neighbour's. She said the first thing she did with her winnings was go and buy a cotton jumper in Marks and Spencer's in every colour before throwing the receipt away so she couldn't return them. And they got financial advice, but they went down to London for a press conference. And she said Camelot, you know, met up with them, verified the ticket and so on. And she said they brought in a banker who gave us the cheque. He asked us if we wanted any money now, as he'd brought £20,000 in cash. But I said no, as there was no way I was walking around London with that much money.
Good idea.
They then got put in touch with financial advisors and will writers and everything like that. She very generously gave £1 million to her brother.
That is very generous.
That is very generous. Yeah, that's almost half. Didn't invest the money, gave herself and give herself an annual allowance. But her husband Derek is an accountant, so they didn't have any problems, you know, making it last and holding on to it. But she now works visiting new winners and giving advice to lottery winners. And the first thing she says they should do is take a holiday. And they still play the lottery every week after their win 24 years ago out of habit. But they're still happily living off their winnings. So that's they're better off than me, who's still playing the lottery every week and hasn't bloody won anything.
Do they still use the same numbers that they did 25 years ago?
Well, they're no less likely to come up. Statistically speaking, I believe I'm correct in saying that it is just as likely that the same numbers would come up every single draw as different ones. But obviously that's not going to happen because they are balls just randomly chosen from a pot, and those balls, the only thing that defines those balls as the number is by the fact that we've put the number on them. So any of those balls could come out on any given occasion. There is a story in our 25 lottery facts of someone who won the lottery twice in the same go with the same numbers. They'd bought two tickets, and so they ended up splitting the winnings with themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah, and nearly missed out on hundreds of thousands of pounds because they forgot that they'd bought a second ticket, because they'd obviously done it by accident. Because, I mean, even I wouldn't buy two tickets with the same numbers on it, thinking that it would increase my chances. and if this idiot here isn't that stupid, I'm thinking most other people aren't. But yes, so they nearly lost out on some of the winnings.
So the question then is, and I have plugged that into the inflation calculator, and 2.7 million in 1994 would be worth, what do you reckon?
£5 million now.
George?
3.3.
Simon, it is 5.326 million. That's not a bad guess.
Cheeky.
That's a lot of inflation.
No, that was a guess. But then that's 1995 is quite a long time ago.
Yeah,
it's 25 years. 1994, sorry, isn't it? 25 years.
Where were you born,
yeah. George? 94. I was minus three.
Oh, wow. I do remember thinking, I need to be 16. And I also remember thinking the same as you, Simon. No one cares.
I've never played the lottery. However, I did once buy a scratch card on a Ryanair flight to Tenerife.
That is
That is my sole experience of any of this. I didn't win anything on that either.
No. What would you do then with £5.3 million then? George, I'll go to you first.
God, because this is going to mark me out as a massive materialist, isn't it?
I don't care.
Well, fair enough.
Own it, George.
An Aston Martin, a pair of very expensive sunglasses, and then probably a house as well.
That is not what I was expecting.
What, really?
I thought you'd be like, oh, well, I'd invest it and I'd put some into a pension and I'd buy a house and
I'm not. I know I'm sort of employed to be sensible and financially minded, but, you know, sometimes when the day job's over. It's, yeah, I'd probably, or I might be like Noel Gallagher when Noel Gallagher stopped buying drugs in the 90s and he just started buying Adidas trainers instead.
Right.
That was how he got off.
I'd recommend drugs. Adidas trainers generally over you know, given the choice. But you only really need one, don't you?
Pair of Adidas trainers?
Yeah.
Nah.
Any.
No, you need loads.
I mean, I think they say one pair of Adidas trainers is enough to tip you over the line. It's a gateway sneaker.
Indeed. What would you spend it on, Simon, apart from loads of Adidas sneakers?
Sneakers. Mm. I know. What horrible Americanism. Mm. In the spirit of George's answer, I'd have a Ferrari over an Aston Martin, actually. I'd rather have a Ferrari. I quite like to own a Ferrari. I might buy a classic Ferrari, not a new one. Fancy a Ferrari Dino. But I'd buy an E-Type, Jaguar E-Type. I would buy as my car. Would I buy an expensive pair of sunglasses? I bought some new sunglasses in the summer and they weren't actually that expensive. I still like them. I think I'll probably survive with those for the time being. What I would do is I would look to spend some of the money. I would definitely spend some of the money. I think that advice of go on holiday straight away is the best thing you could possibly do. I would be writing a letter to my children's school saying that they will be being taken out of school under the exceptional circumstances that their father has finally broken his 25-year duck and won the lottery. And then I think while you're away, you can have a little bit of a think about it. I would try to invest the money so that I was getting some form of annual income from it that I could live off. I would probably want to invest the money in starting some form of entrepreneurial endeavour or my own business or something that would keep me interested and occupied. I would probably give some to friends and family. And that would be, it's a very difficult choice in terms of how you do that and how much you give people and whether the money that you are giving them is actually going to do them any favours in some cases. Mm. I know some people who it wouldn't do any favours to. And I would also probably give some of it to a good cause, maybe. But in all reality, do you know what I'd do? I would be snowboarding all winter. I would snowboard all winter and I would surf all summer. And when people say, oh, I wouldn't know what to do, I'd get bored of it, I would say, my response to that is, I think you lack imagination and need to get yourself some form of time-consuming hobby.
True.
But I think it's very difficult, especially in the position I'd be in where I've got two young children. You know, my kids are 9 and nearly 7. And if you suddenly become, you know, multi-millionaire type rich, then it'd be quite easy to ruin them. You'd be quite easy to ruin yourself, but at least, you know, you're your own responsibility. It would be quite easy to ruin the kids. You'd have to be very careful about it. And you've also, you know, they've got to go to school and do all these other things. And it's all very well dad saying, well, I'm off snowboarding for the next 5 months and then you find me at the beach. But they can't come with you and do that, so.
Yeah. 5.3 million, though, it's not going to ruin your kids' lives, is it?
Well, you can live a millionaire lifestyle on it, can't you? I mean, so you buy yourself a nice big swanky house, and do you end
Depends
up...
Where you're buying
do you it. Do you buy yourself a big swanky country house that's bigger than you need? Do you go for something that's actually more suited to the size? But then you've got cash that you can start... But you don't have to worry about your cash at that level. You can start spending it. You could spend your way through it. There's an interesting statistic here that 20% of people who've won the lottery are now poorer than the day that they actually won the lottery on. Not poorer than before they bought the ticket, poorer than the day they won the lottery on. But you could start... You don't have to be that wealthy to give your kids a very bad example by splashing the cash and chucking money around and things. What would you do with the money, Georgie?
I would probably... I haven't thought too much about this, so before anyone, you know, complains at my ill-thought-out plans here. I know both my parents are trying to sell their houses, so I'd probably just buy it off them and say, look, live there, chill out for free. And then I'd probably do an eat, pray, love thing. Big fan of Julia Roberts. Not such a big fan of the movie. But yeah, I like the concept. You know, I'd spend 4 months in, say, Spain learning the language and just eating and getting fat. And then I want to get to the Galapagos Islands or somewhere around there, like sail for 4 months and then somewhere else. You know, that kind of... Maybe like a sporting trip around the world, like go to things like the San Siro and, you know, all those sorts of places that I've not been before. That would be cool.
Sounds quite wholesome.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And I might stick some in a pension and, you know, invest some. That kind of stuff. But that's what I would do. I wouldn't be very sensible, but yes, might get a pair of new Adidas sneakers as well. But what we've also been sort of not concentrating, except you, Simon, you are obviously a better, greater person than George and I. You've focused on charity there. I would like to think I'd give some money to charity as well. But obviously, the lottery has done a lot of good for charitable causes. 40 billion in total that it's handed out. However, the non-partisan think tank, the Social Media Foundation, wants the National Lottery to go a step further. And so Lee Boyce has been ruminating on this idea, this win to save or a new savings game that the Social Market Foundation wants the National Lottery to start in 2023 and to help those who don't have any savings. So it seems a bit of a contradiction in terms that something that encourages people to spend would also encourage people to save. George, do you want to tackle this and tell us what the plan is?
As Lee's standing, I will do my best. Well, it's interesting because obviously you have a lot of talk about, say, something like income tax, which is what you would call a progressive tax. It goes up as the more you earn, the more you pay. It seems the lottery is not even a flat tax, but it's a regressive tax in that a large percentage or proportion of lottery tickets are bought by people on the lowest income scales. Mm. So I've been writing some stuff recently on pensions and on the massive success of auto-enrolment, particularly among people in their 20s. So, for example, 84% of 20-year-olds are now enrolled in a workplace pension compared to about 14% when auto-enrolment started. So what you take from that and the success of that is that sometimes people who are in a position where they think they can't save or struggle to save or in a position where they really can't save might be best benefited by having it taken out before, without the option of them being able to do it. That was my instinctive reaction when I saw this, which the whole point is you would buy a ticket for £2.50 and £1.75 of that would be kind of stashed away for you to save. So someone who bought one ticket a week would build up £126 in savings a year, or if you're like Simon and buy two a week, £252 a year in savings. Now perhaps that could be combined with something like, well, it's interesting actually because you've got government saving schemes like Help to Save, which tops up money you can spend, money you save with about 50% top up, up to a certain amount, and then something like the Lifetime ISA, designed to help people save for retirement or a first home, which gives you a government bonus. Now, some of these have seen quite little uptake, which is weird because it's the government handing out free money, but because it still requires people to consciously save, you're in a situation where even schemes where you're telegraphing this by saying the government is giving you free money are still taking a limited amount of uptake. So I was reading this, I thought it was a really interesting piece, and I'm fully in favour of it, because if you see like something like auto-enrolment, it's if you take the step on behalf of people, then you see a massive benefit. That's my two cents.
Simon?
I think it's quite a good idea, and it's been a success elsewhere. So it's talking about, Lee in his column talked about this win and save lottery that's been successful in Michigan. Launched in 2009, participants have saved a cumulative $190 million with an average of $2,409 saved in each account. That's quite big. I'm quite impressed with that. And I guess people just get into the habit. It's about getting people into the savings habit and getting them to understand that they can just save small amounts of money, and that if you save a small amount of money over a long time, then it does make a difference. You're certainly not going to get much in the way of interest. Mm-hmm. And if you look at how popular premium bonds are, there's no reason why this kind of thing couldn't work. And it gives an example of a system that we already have in terms of premium bonds. But I guess if you look at the premium bond figures, you will see that, as with any form of savings or wealth, they skew towards the more wealthy in society, whereas, as George points out, the lottery skews towards the poorer people in society and the more wealthy like me who just keep playing it. But I think that, yeah, so it's a decent idea. Why not do it? We've had 25 years of the lottery. Why not do it? The question is, though, if you had two systems, right, so you've got the National Lottery and you've got the Win and Save Lottery, and you've got £2, and if you put your £2 into the National Lottery, you get £2 worth of a crack at winning a couple of million pounds. Mm. And if you do it into the Win and Save Lottery, you get a 25p or 60p crack at winning a smaller sum of money, and you get £1.50 into the savings account. You might be tempted to go, I'll gamble my £2 because it's only £2, even though you could have it very carefully explained to you that your odds of winning the Win and Save one are actually greater than your chances of becoming a millionaire on the lottery.
I can't remember what the stat was, but something like the lowest income in America spend 9% or something of their income and their earnings on the lottery, 9 to 10%, which is extraordinary when you think about it. when you say I can't save because I don't earn enough, and then you're spending that amount of money on the lottery. But it also says something about your hope.
Yeah, it says that what you've decided is your best chance.
Yeah,
the best chance that you have of getting ahead in life is to spend 10% of your income on trying to win an extremely, long odds gamble. But then you look at gambling, you look at betting, fixed odd betting terminals that are being so controversial. Mm-hmm. You look even at old fashioned, betting on the horses and things like that. And again, you find that in terms of habit and people who spend large portions of their earnings on it, that skews towards people who have less money to spare anyway too.
All right, well, let's move on, because we're talking about those who struggle to save, and I imagine students might be up there. But what about offering them a mortgage with no deposit required? What the heck is this? Just to explain a little bit, we started to record this as I introed the podcast, but when we got to this story, I had to chastise you, I think, George, because you laughed, you snorted, when I think is probably more accurate, when I suggested this story.
Yes.
And I don't think that was a laugh of approval of this concept of this, giving students a mortgage with no deposit required.
This idea is chum. This idea is absolute
chum.
Nonsense. Absolute nonsense,
is this
right?
What the young people say now.
No, not George? At all.
Oh, right.
So I reckon I have a theory about how this idea might have come about, which is
what is the idea? Who is it? What's happening?
So the idea is basically, wouldn't it be great if, as a student, you would own a student house and you and your mates could all live together and you'd be your landlord? And their landlord.
In my experience of student life, that would not be what I would want to do, be a landlord with my mates.
But this is sort of something that should never have really got behind a sort of brainstorming session before someone did a little bit of thinking and thought about all the ways that it didn't work. So basically what this building society is offering is 100% no deposit mortgage on houses of up to £300,000. Mm. And it's basically a guarantor mortgage in that it requires your parents to stump up about 20% of capital of the value of the home as a guarantee, and then as security, and also to make the payments if you can't.
Now, which is, as a concept, isn't new. There are other schemes that do something.
It's a guarantor buy-to-let mortgage, essentially.
The difference being students.
Students.
Right.
So, first of all, this is a moral abomination, because The whole point of being a student is that you
trash the house.
Is that you are all in this crap together.
That's true.
So think about it. The young ones wouldn't work as a series if Rick was the landlord.
Oh, I don't know. Not a bad series for a spin-off there, but yeah.
Rick Mayall rather than Alexis Sayles, landlord. So that's one reason. But then also, it doesn't really work in a financial sense either. Now, I asked a friend of mine is who's my age, is also a buy-to-let landlord and has a couple of properties in Nottingham. Not student properties, regular properties.
He's how old? 20?
22.
Right.
Didn't go to uni.
Right.
Smart
man.
So I asked him what he thought of this, and he gave me a couple of calculations, right? So say you've got a £250,000 four-bed home and you're living in it, so you're not going to charge yourself rent, so you're getting rent from three people. Say that's £85 per person a week times three people times 45 weeks. You've got rent of £11,475. 4.7% interest, which is what's being offered by Vernon Building Society in this situation, on a £250,000 property is £11,750. So you're already in the red before you have to do any of the other stuff that a landlord has to do, like fix the boiler,
whatever,
renovations. So that's all on your shoulders. And then what's more, you have to make up the shortfall, and then if one of your friends leaves the property or can't pay, it's your problem. If one of your friends can't pay, you need them to pay, but you're your friends and you don't want to go sending the bailiffs around on your flatmate and your best mate to get them to pay up.
Exactly.
Then also, you're earning that income, you're still earning that income, so any income that you've got from a part-time job, as students often have at uni, will push you into paying basic rent tax, which means you've got even less money to spend on uni. And then there's the question, he says, of whether parents would trust their 18-year-old to properly manage a student buy-to-let to the extent that they'd secure their house against the deposit. At 18 years of age, when I went to uni, I could not be a buy-to-let landlord. At 21 years of age, at 22 years of age, I could not be a buy-to-let landlord.
Mm.
So, chum.
Yeah. Yeah, chum. Moral abomination, Simon. A moral abomination.
Yeah, I heard that. I thought, don't hold back, George. And then I thought this was going to be a tirade about the evils of buy-to-let and everything. But I love the fact that his argument was, you're meant to all be in it together and that doesn't work if one of you's the landlord. So, look, I would offer up a couple of observations on this. Mm-hmm. Firstly, student properties tend to be not the greatest homes that you'll ever live in.
No.
If you buy one for you and your mates to live in and rent it out, it's a very strong chance that you and your mates, yes, you're not all in it together, as George said, but that you're going to end up living in a considerably nicer place than the one that's owned by a landlord with multiple student properties who doesn't do any of the things they promised to do when you took out the contract. If I think back to our massive rambling house in Leeds in the second year, all those things that the agent, all those things that the agency said they were going to do, and then they never did. So I think that you would end up with a better place, and you'll look after it better, and maybe the helping hand of the parent here would come into play and you know, kind of improve it. But I do also think that there is a problem here, and we're talking the second year, right? So most people live in halls in their first year, and that's where they meet their friends, and then, you know, it's round about now that people start talking about getting together, finding mates to where they're going to rent next year. So there's people that you've been mates with for 2 months, 3 months, if you're lucky. And then January time, it really kicks off. But everyone's talking about it now because it's like everybody knows it kicks off in January. So now you need to start talking about it now.
You get the nice
find the best places,
December,
kind of thing. Yeah. So you're not very far into your friendship with these people. And really, are you ready to go into this in the second year? So even if you are ready to go into this in the second year, most degrees are 3 years. So you're talking about 2 years. If you're owning a property for 2 years, you shouldn't be owning a property. You don't buy a property to own it for 2 years. You buy a property to own it for 5 years. You don't make an investment. If this is an investment and this is what this is, then you don't make an investment over a two-year period in something that's as illiquid as a property, particularly with house prices stagnating at the moment. You should do it over a longer period of time than that. So I think it can be worth doing in that sense, if you know that you're going to stick around for a while, if you know that you might be there for longer, if you have other family members at the same university or all those other kinds of things. But the interest rate is expensive, you know, because it's 100% mortgage and it's guarantored rather than being a big deposit, and it's buy-to-let, so the rates are a bit higher on that. So yeah, that does drive up the monthly costs, and I think it is filed under one of those, wouldn't it be nice if we did this? Or, I know this guy and he did it and they made loads of money. But as we keep talking about, those days are gone of making lots of money and capital appreciation on a property. House prices absolutely went bananas between 1997 and 2007. They then fell. In some parts of the country, they've only just regained the peak. But in other parts of the country, they fell and then went bananas again. But that stopped. They're flatlining at the moment, and there was a forecast from Savills this week over the next 5 years suggesting that property prices would rise by an average of 15%. And you think, well, that sounds quite a lot, doesn't it? 15%, up another 15%. When you break that down over 5 years, that's just over 2% a year. That's not really that much money. A lot of the gains that come from property come from the fact that you're doing it on borrowed money. You know, you're doing it on a mortgage, but that also means that you can, you're left at the mercy of falling into negative equity, of it being your money that you lose first and everything like that. And so I think it's a slightly dangerous game, and you're seeing more and more of this stuff going on with mortgage lenders.
Why are they doing this?
Because they've got lots of money and they don't have as many people to borrow it as they'd like to borrow it, which is what's driving down mortgage rates in the normal residential market to extremely low levels. There's less people moving home, there's less people buying houses. First-time buyer numbers are doing pretty well, but first-time buyers, obviously, by definition, tend to buy smaller or less expensive properties. And so they're trying to find ways to lend more money to people. We had the Yorkshire Building Society, which is one of the more prudent big financial institutions, this week, lowering its mortgage rates on 10% deposit mortgages and saying that it would now lend up to £600,000 to people, justifying that on the basis of the fact that homes in London are so expensive and it's tough for first-time buyers to buy on a 10% deposit mortgage if they've got a lower lending limit. But borrowing £600,000 on your first mortgage, with only putting a 10% deposit down. Wow, I mean, we're straight out the back of the wardrobe there, aren't we?
Straight out the back of the wardrobe.
Yeah, Narnia.
To Narnia, yeah.
You learned all about terms today, George.
I know, right? This is an education. All I keep thinking about was finding coffee cups at the backs of wardrobes and on top of wardrobes when we left the house that I'd left there, just full of mould. And one final thought on that was if you weren't fortunate enough to win the lottery, but you did buy a house during that period, you suggested there, Simon, you did win a lottery of some sort, which you have discussed in the past. Now, something that perhaps some of us have wondered at one time or another, how much information is shared about you online? So you have an email from a reader. This is quite specifically about banks. I recently obtained a new Visa debit card from Lloyds. Went to update all my subscription services. But when I went onto Now TV, I saw that it already had them. I thought I'd been scammed, but it turns out my bank had automatically told it that my card had been updated. I'm shocked that the bank would do this. Is this automatically the case? And what companies is this service available to?
Well, it's funny because this was obviously filed under our Ask an Expert section, and the expert on this occasion was not me.
Oh.
Because right. Never heard of this before.
Right, yeah.
Amazingly. So
this is your article, yeah?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. To understand this, you need to know two acronyms on this, ABU and VAU. ABU is Automatic Billing Updater, which is a service offered by MasterCard. Visa Account Updater is the equivalent from Visa. So now, essentially what happens is, banks, when you sign up to a bank account, there will be a section likely in their terms and conditions that you opt into sharing your data with relevant third parties. And what this is because subscription services don't want to see gaps in payments. So you think about it before, when you cancelled your card, say you lost your card, cancelled your card, you'd have to go back. And we all subscribe to everything nowadays. No one buys anything anymore. Everyone subscribes to everything. And because those are recurring card payments, often rather than direct debits, that's contingent on the card, not on your bank account. So you have to go through and update them all. Or that was the past. Now, this is the future, or the present. In that what happens is your bank automatically will talk using ABU or VAU to MasterCard or to Visa to let them know, because you've opted into this automatically, your new card details, be that the big digit number on the front or the expiry date, there's something that would cause the payment to fail otherwise. They will tell MasterCard or Visa, and then MasterCard or Visa will have this database, and basically any big merchant, be it Netflix, Amazon,
Uber,
Now TV, that offers a subscription service of some kind, can tap into that database and update their payment details accordingly, so they don't miss out on that nice juicy £7.99 a month fee.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, is that... There's half of me that goes, I know, because I had a really bad year where I either lost my debit card or it got scammed or something, and I had three times this happened to me, which was very annoying. And I had to go through the process of, and that's why I mentioned Uber, because it's the things that you don't think about until it's 11 o'clock at night and you need to get home, and then you go, oh, what have I... Anyway. So in that regard, I can think, yes, this is absolutely sensible. In other regards, I think, ooh.
This is terrifying.
Yeah.
It's the convenience, isn't it? It's really convenient, but then also you go...
And it's not for you. It's not so you don't have to get it, so they don't miss out on this, and it goes back to this win-to-save idea you had about inertia.
Yes. Well, I suppose in the defence of such a scheme, you could argue that if you didn't want the subscription anymore, you should cancel it, not just change your bank card or stop paying for it. And until you've taken out a contract with someone for that subscription, and until you cancel it,
yeah, of course,
you have a contract with them. But it's cheeky, isn't it? It's really cheeky. And it sounds so wrong, I think, because we attach a weird sort of personal importance to our bank account numbers, to the point where there was even this suggestion years back that the way to get people to switch bank accounts was to allow them to take their bank account number and their sort code with them to port it in the same way they would their mobile number, which I always thought was crazy. I was like, well, you know what, it's just a number, and yes, you might be able to remember it, but you've probably got the mental capacity, if you've remembered one number, to remember another number, and then you'll just keep using it so you'll remember it, and so on and so on. But actually, when you polled people and asked them whether they thought it was a good idea, people did say that having to get a new sort code and a new bank account number was something that held them back from moving banks. So you can therefore see how on the other end, even though they're not getting a new bank account number and sort code because they're with the same bank, the roll number down the middle of their card, it's got the same sort of personal significance and attraction to it. So they think that they have in some way had been slightly violated by their new number going across to the same provider.
The cheeky thing as well, because you've automatically opted in, what you've got to do, you have to go to your bank. It's nothing to do with MasterCard or Visa. They only operate the database. To opt out from the system, you have to go to your bank. And your bank, it's their discretion whether they allow you to opt out or not. So they force you to opt in, but it's their discretion whether they allow you to opt out or not. So in the case of this reader, we spoke to Lloyds, and Lloyds said that Lloyds did not currently offer an opt-out function from this.
Wow.
However, we are always... What was it? It was, however, we are always listening to customer feedback and will, you know, change depending on how people feel. Something like that. It's so you're roped into it, basically.
That's really naughty, I think.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. So it's like, you know that old test of when people talk about something being free and all you have to do is provide these details or spend this money. And it's like, it's not free if you have to spend some money. It's also not an opt-out if they get to choose whether you're allowed to opt out.
Yeah, I don't like the sound of that, and I don't like the response either. We're always listening to our customers.
Just very quickly, whilst we're on banking and banking innovations, before we move on, I would like to praise something for once on this podcast. Starling Bank. I have a Starling Bank account that I took out because it offers fee-free spending overseas, and I thought, well, do you know what? I'll try it out. And you can open a bank account and get your card within 2 to 3 days. And fair play to Starling, because I'm the kind of idiot who doesn't do anything until the last minute. They got me both of those bank cards before I went on holiday in the summer in less than the 2 to 3 day period. But they also offer a Euro bank account. So you can open a separate bank account within your suite of accounts on the app that you can hold Euros in. And all you do is basically you pay some money in. They charge you a small, like maybe 1% or something, but they don't load the rate against you. So you're paying a bit for the Euros, but no more than you would do if you're actually buying the Euros or something. But it's dead good if you need to pay for something in Europe and you need to pay for something in Euros. So I needed to pay for a deposit for a hotel and things like that, or when you're paying, for example, for properties that you rent and stuff like that, is always an absolute nightmare because you've got to get the IBAN number and then you've got to do some kind of currency transfer and all this other stuff. Dead easy. Just did it straight from the app, paid the hotel the money, done and dusted. Cost me no more than it would have done. In fact, probably less to like use a currency transfer service or something like that. So well done to some people in the banking industry.
Well done indeed. You tried to lighten the mood there, Simon, but I'm going to drag it right back down again, because I'm going to talk about something I'd actually genuinely almost forgotten about. This, the most annoying shopping event of the year, basically. It doesn't even pretend to be something. That's what sort of annoys me about it. It's not like Valentine's Day or Singles Day, even Mother's Day, right? It's not even bloody day. It's weeks of shopping madness. But ignoring the fights over TVs, whether it's ruined the Christmas sales, impacting shops negatively, getting us to overspend, etc., etc., there is one group who absolutely love Black Friday, and that's the scammers. So how do we avoid them? But firstly, Black Friday. Simon, I can't be the only one that absolutely hates it. What is the point of it?
Okay, Black Friday is an American import, and like like many American imports, it's not that good. There are American imports that we've had that have been absolutely cracking, but Black Friday is not one of them. It is the day after Thanksgiving. Am I correct in that? So it's kind of like the Boxing Day. Because Thanksgiving's a massive thing over there. They actually get a day off. You don't get many days off in America, so you've got to celebrate when you do get
one. That's true.
And people go shopping. It's their equivalent of the Boxing Day sales, but has been driven into a massive frenzy by the rise of online shopping and then the rise of the online shopping giants who like to bring their shopping events over here. They don't like to pay their tax over here, but they do like to bring their shopping events over here. So it's become a thing. I think it's a bit of a busted flush in this country. I think if you speak to retailers, they're very much divided on whether they're actually going to take part and think it's a good thing, or whether they even feel compelled to take part. Some of them argue that all they're doing is pulling forward spending that would otherwise be made on Christmas stuff, but having to offer deep discounts, and so therefore they're costing themselves money. And also, if you think about the way the insane retail calendar now works, the Christmas sales now all start before Christmas, and anybody knows that if you just wait until a week before Christmas to buy the stuff that you want to buy, it's going to be in sale and it's going to be cheaper. And until the shops actually stop doing that, what you've ended up with is a very truncated Christmas shopping period where stuff is on sale for full price, because you've got Black Friday, and then of course shops can't, they can't just do Black Friday, can they? They have
Black
to do
Friday weekend.
Black Friday, yeah, Black Friday
it's
weekend.
Not even a week.
Black Friday in the aftermath. It's like we're still, our Black Friday sale is still
Cyber
on.
Cyber Monday.
And it's like, yeah, it's nearly December now. It's like, stop, quick,
like,
because otherwise there'll be another
films.
Sale.
It just keeps going, it keeps going.
It's nowhere near as good as Fast and the Furious films.
No. That's an American import that is good.
Well, I must admit, I've only ever watched the first one. So.
Come on, they're like seven. Anyway, that we digress.
I think that's fine. So, but wherever you have a scenario where people are spending lots of money, or particular spending lots of money and doing a lot of it on the internet, you obviously have an opportunity for some people who might like to try and scam people.
Right.
And that is why we are talking about Black Friday scams, because there's lots of scammers who think that it's a great idea. You don't need to tempt people with much to get them to come to your website. And there has been a lot of criticism previously of people saying, well, how much do you actually check who this company is before you hand over your bank details to buy something from them? So when someone offers you that, yeah, Adidas sneakers,
yeah,
at a massively discounted price, you think, ooh, 85% off, Black Friday, I'll buy those. Not, ooh, I'm about to spend 15% of the price of what Adidas trainers would normally cost me to get nothing in return because someone's going to steal the money.
Yeah. But also, I mean, this is where it annoys me about things like Amazon. What started as the kind of Black Friday sales now becomes this ridiculous, you've got 1 hour to unlock this, almost bidding war if you go on and take a look. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So that it encourages people to have that mindset of, I must buy something, quick. Oh, I haven't checked that this website is legit. And not even whether it's legit. Is it a genuine bargain? That's what annoys me, is I don't trust any of these. Mind you, I don't trust sales generally. Take a look out there to see what else is around. Isn't there Camel that can check Amazon prices throughout the year? And there are other websites you can use as well. But and what are the tips of avoiding the scammers, George, and just keeping a sane head?
Well, for example, if you see something on Facebook that says you can get 90% off Canada Goose, but the website is based in Gabon, that's likely should ring some alarm bells.
It's pretty hot in Gabon. They don't have that many big jackets.
No, exactly.
Saying that, though, can I just point out, I did buy a marvellous Arsene Wenger duvet coat in LA recently.
Have you been able to do the zip up?
50%, 50% discount. Mm. But that is because nobody would wear that coat in LA. But anyway, carry on. So it could plausibly be in Gabon. I'm not saying anything, you know.
Well,
unlikely.
Well, okay, so a better tell apparently is not that something is a Gabonese website, and would instead be, it's a little padlock. Little padlock in the top corner of our homepage is always a web URL is always a good indication. So check the name. Do you recognise the website? Do you trust the retailer? If something's too good to be true, it almost certainly is. Don't trust anything you see shared on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram without doing some due diligence outside of it, because what we're seeing now increasingly is that being used as a way to target scammers, especially something like Instagram or Snapchat.
Yeah.
Usually that's more with other kind of investment scams or stuff, but this time of year, it's likely it'll be, you know, retail scams of some sort. Scam emails, always a good one. Always check the email address you get from stuff. Take a second. Most websites and companies that find themselves victims of impersonation emails have a phishing service which you can forward the email to if you're in any kind of doubt. So just take a minute, forward it to it. If it comes back and it's clean, absolutely fine, no problem at all. The deal would probably still be there. This was a good one as well that I noticed, was one of these other ones, is avoid purchases on public Wi-Fi.
Oh, yeah.
It's a really good one. I never check banking or anything on public Wi-Fi. I know it's probably all encrypted, but I'm still kind of paranoid about it. I do it on 4G or I'll wait until home or work Wi-Fi.
That's a good tip.
Yeah, the public Wi-Fi ones.
There are a lot more adverts, actually, about about logging onto public Wi-Fi and just being extra careful.
We had an excellent story earlier this year from Toby Warne, our colleague on the Mail on Sunday, about how easy it was to scam people using the public Wi-Fi that's unpassword. Basically, you need one that's password protected. It is surprisingly easy to basically, you know, scam you off the back of it. And people just don't think about it. People just think about making stuff easy, don't they?
Yeah.
You know, because you'll actually get the thing where it's like, oh, I've got two choices, the Wi-Fi. That one wants a password. I can't bother to jump through that hoop. I'm just going to press the one that doesn't have a password. And that's apparently the wrong move.
I'd imagine so. But you know what? You've only got 30 minutes to buy those Adidas sneakers, Simon. I mean, you know, what can you do? Right, that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team, or you want to let us know what you'd spend £5.3 million on, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. You can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join in the comments. And the one thing I would say is if you fancy emailing us, and if you've got a question about the one thing that we haven't mentioned today, and no, I'm not talking about the B word. I think we've managed to do an entire podcast without doing it. But the E word. There's this election thing coming up. We haven't talked about it. Why haven't we talked about it? Well, because despite all the noise that you've been hearing about it, I don't think anybody's actually bothered to put out a manifesto yet, have they? So who knows what will come out? I mean, I think Labour's going to give out free puppies and, you know, Boris Johnson's going to do X, Y, and Z.
4-day weeks and everything.
4-day weeks, free puppies, free broadband. Boris Johnson's going to do
every... Whatever you spend on the NHS, we'll spend more.
Yeah, every single working day in a Superman suit, that kind of thing.
Hulk.
Yeah, and yeah, not to leave the Lib Dems out because I know they get upset about it. Joe Swinson will personally come round your house and tell you off every day.
Yeah.
Tell you to buck your ideas up, young man.
T-shirt.
Yeah, exactly. So when the manifestos come out, we'll go through some of the financial and money stuff in there. But if you've got questions about it, email us in and put election podcast in the subject line so it doesn't get lost in the hundreds, if not thousands, of emails we get every day. And we will try to find out the answers to those questions, even if it means putting it to the useless bunch at the political parties who are not very good at actually answering questions about their policies.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.